Welcome to Green and Red, Scrappy Politics for Scrappy People, a regular podcast on radical, environmental and anti-capitalist politics, brought to you by Bob Bazanko and Scott Parkin.
Welcome to the Silky Smooth Sounds of the Green and Red podcast. I'm your co-host, Scott Parkin, in Berkeley, California, and I am joined, as always, by
Bob Bazanko from the Socialist Republic of Ohio.
The Socialist Republic of Ohio.
The whole country is socialist from what I hear.
Yeah. And that's why communists are bad, because socialism is everywhere, running rampant. We have to have a coup at some point. It's so bad that the president has to go and hide in catering vans or catering containers with his human binky or whatever it is they call her to escape the Islamo-communist hordes.
Yeah, because nothing has more in common than Islam and communism.
So yeah, exactly.
Of course, they're the same thing.
Exactly. And speaking of the guy who fled the catering truck, and the reasons he fled is because he was apparently scared that Iran was going to shoot him out of the sky. The third anniversary of the coup in Iran, 1953 coup. And so we're going to be talking about that a little bit, and then we're going to be talking about current events related to the coup. And then we have a couple of other extra things that we want to just kind of throw into the show today. But I will hand it off to Bob to kick off with the background on the 53 coup.
Yeah, this is fun because I've written about this and thought about it forever. And lately, I think more people are learning about it. I can't tell you, I've seen probably 125-year-olds do a TikTok saying, "You won't believe this, but," because no one ever heard of it before. But at any rate, it's interesting, and I think it's really important because a lot of the kind of structure of global politics is still in play. Been different, but it's still in play. We have empires and hegemonic structures and interference in other countries and so forth. The coup took place against Mohammad Mossadegh in 1953, but I want to go back a little because there is a really important, I think, backstory. Iran in 1946 actually was the first kind of aggressive encounter in the, at that point, emerging Cold War. The first potential for armed conflict took place in Iran in early 1946. During World War II, the Americans, the British, and the Russians jointly occupied Iran, which was important because of the same reason it is today, oil, right? Harry Truman said the loss of Iranian oil would be a serious loss for the economy of the Western world. And he said, after the war ended, that Russia's continued presence and influence in Iran. Iran did have a communist party, the Tudeh party. He said that the Russian influence, the Soviet influence there, was a potential threat to our immensely rich oil holdings in Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and Kuwait. The more things change, right? This is exactly what we're seeing in 2026, right? With attacks on Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and Kuwait for that very reason. By late 1945, most of the American and British troops had withdrawn, but the Soviets hadn't. They were demanding oil rights as well, under the basic theory that we occupied and protected Iran during the war, so we should get some reward for it, right? Because the Americans, the British controlled oil in the region, and the Soviets were also supporting communist kind of an insurgency in Azerbaijan as well. It's interesting, and I don't want to go too much into detail here, but I think this is really fascinating stuff because it also talks a lot about what socialism is when you actually try to implement it, right? The Soviet Union, working with the Tudeh Party in Iran, put together a program, and they wanted the Azerbaijani communists, who were really taking the lead in that, to develop a social welfare program, to give land to peasants, to create jobs by building roads and creating public works programs, to improve the public health system, provide equal rights to minorities and tribes, and maintain taxes for local uses, right? That was their communist agenda: roads, schools, buildings, taxes for local use, right? And obviously the United States and the British saw that as just a non-starter. It was unacceptable. This would essentially be like a New Deal program, and nothing more than that, which I think is important because when we get to Mossadegh, that's what we're looking at. At any rate, the United States wouldn't negotiate, wouldn't make any concessions. And through what they called diplomacy, which was actually more like strong army, there were clearly threats, although don't know if the United States said, hey, we have an atomic bomb or anything like that. The U.S. went to the U.N., condemned the Soviet Union. And in early 1946, Soviet troops left Iran with a promise, nothing but, that at some point a Soviet-Iranian oil company would be established, subject to approval by the Iranian parliament, the Majlis, which obviously didn't happen. All right, so that's in 1946. And it's important, I think, for the general narrative of the Cold War as well as Iran. Stalin retreated. And in every encounter in the Cold War, Stalin retreated. So the idea of this Soviet force trying to take over the entire world, communism, having this global crusade to take everything, never was true, never existed. That was never going to happen. Now, to move forward a bit, even though that particular part of the Cold War had ended, the internal demand for control over its own oil in Iran continued. There was a strong movement inside Iran, and that kept going after 1946, really without missing a beat. There was a strong nationalist movement there, which wanted to take control of the oil fields, right? And that's where we get to the coup that happened 73 years ago today. U.S. companies produced almost 50% of the oil in the Middle East, in the entire region. And Europe got 90% of its oil from the Middle East. So it's very clear how important that was. In Iran, the biggest oil firm was the AIOC, the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company. And to the Iranian people, those who didn't have some kind of collaborative stake in that oil company, the AIOC was just a symbol of imperialism, of these Western colonial empires coming in and trying to take over. And this is a time when you have the building up, the kind of bubbling of Arab nationalism, which is going to really become big after Nasser takes over Egypt in 1953. In 1949, a member of the Majlis, the Congress there, the parliament there, was Mohammad Mossadegh. And he created an anti-AIOC, the oil company, let's just call it anti-British, anti-American alliance called the National Front. And the National Front demanded a new arrangement between the Iranians and the oil companies, right? And this is, I remember when I first read this, I didn't believe it. So I had to look it up, right? And confirm it, which I did. In 1950, the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company earned profits in the range of about 200 million pounds. And at the time, I think a pound was, Bretton Woods would have been in place by now. So it would have been 240, right? So 200 million pounds, right? But Iran only got 8% of that in royalties. So the British took 92% of the profit from Iranian oil, oil that was in. What did Dick Cheney say? It's not our fault that God didn't put oil under the land of American ally. I forget what it was, right? But that's true, right?
Yeah.
The company's profits, the AOC profits in 1950 alone, exceeded the profits that Iran had made from oil in the previous 50 years combined, which is when their oil industry developed, right? So in 1 year, Britain made more money off Iranian oil than Iranians had ever made. Cumulative, right? And in fact, Iranians had to pay taxes on those oil fields for the concessions. So the Iranians received less in royalties than they paid in taxes, right? In 1948 through 1950, Iran received 9 million, 13.5 million, and 16 million pounds in royalties in those 3 years. But they paid 28 million, 23 million, and 50.5 million pounds in taxes. They were losing money on their own oil, right? And the British companies wouldn't even allow the Iranians to see the books, right? So under this arrangement, Mossadegh's committee called for the nationalization of the AIOC. In 1951, the Majlis voted to nationalize the AIOC. I keep wanting to say AOC. I'm talking about her too, because Woke One is dead now, right?
Woke One was crazy.
It's crazy. And the next month, 1951, the Majlis elected Mossadegh to the prime minister's position. Now, what is the U.S. going to call Mossadegh now that this guy wants to nationalize oil? So what is the U.S. attack on Mossadegh going to be? He's a
communist.
Communist, right? He's a communist. This is what. So what Trump is doing today is old as the hills, right? If you know anything about Mossadegh, that's really laughable. Mossadegh was really an old-fashioned liberal, which is what people called him at the time. He was pretty staunchly anti-communist. He was opposed to foreign interference. He was Iran first, right? And he was eccentric. The American media made fun of him. He would have been from a family kind of similar to the Roosevelts or Kennedys. Maybe not quite that affluent, but kind of establishment, right? So he's not a communist at all. He, in fact, rejected the Iranian Communist Party, even though he was
from the elite classes in Iran.
He was an elite class, absolutely, right? And the media made fun of him. He would often, like, he would cry. He would wear pajamas to meet diplomats. So there were these hints that he was gay or that he was losing his mind.
But was he wearing a diaper? Was he wearing a diaper?
I don't know if Natalie Harp was running around with him either, right? But now the Americans wouldn't tolerate this. American policy from World War II on was that the containment of Iran was vital because of its resources, because it had a left movement there, the Tudor Party. The Americans became more involved. In 1951, the executives at the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, after this nationalization vote, approached the British intelligence service, asking them to get rid of Mossadegh. So the company went, it would be like a United Fruit in Guatemala, which is taking place pretty much at the same time, actually, right? And this is the part, like now you have one of the driving forces, obviously, like the oil companies in Venezuela, or in Cuba, you have these old gusanos who are trying to still want to get their land back from 1915 and so on, right? So the AIOC executives went to the British intelligence agents and said, we got to get rid of Mossadegh. But Britain, after World War II, hadn't really recovered and had financial issues and kind of had limits to his own foreign policy. It was dealing with Egypt and India and other places as well. So the British reached out to the CIO for a coup. In addition to that, the AIOC, the company, prevented Iran from selling its own oil in the world market. So their export earnings dropped from $400 million to $2 million a year. The Iranians continued to fight. Mossadegh broke off diplomatic relations with London in October of 1952. So the Americans now are given this. This is stuff put into their lap. Mossadegh is under increasing pressure from the British, from the Americans, from Iranians at home, because obviously this is having an impact on the Iranian economy as well. Mossadegh reached out to Eisenhower, asking him to please stop this interference, this intervention. And Mossadegh even publicly says that he knows that the Americans are giving aid and supporting the British government's attempts to overthrow him, trying to strangle Iran and so forth, right? And Eisenhower, for his part, as you pointed out, keeps invoking communism and the fact that he thinks Mossadegh is a radical and the Soviet Union is behind all this, which in none of these cases, and that's really critical, in Iran in 1946, in Greece in 1946 and 1947, in China, United States, the Soviet Union didn't even support Mao Zedong, the Chinese Communist Party in China, until the very end. They wanted China to remain divided, right? So the U.S. knows this is not the case. The U.S. knows this. The Soviet Union can't. It doesn't have anywhere near the capacity to do that, right? And this is similar today when the U.S. will actually now put Iran at the center. This is Iranian based. These are Iranian terrorists, so on and so forth. Right? Okay. You need this kind of element of fear and this boogeyman, right? Eisenhower even said, if I had $500 million of money to spend in secret, I would get $100 million of it to Iran right now. As soon as Eisenhower, and I will say some decent things about Eisenhower. I remember a few weeks ago how we pointed out that Eisenhower's platform would have been like more or less like DSA's today, right? Not that much different, right? And when he did want to try to tone down some elements of the Cold War, but as soon as he was inaugurated in 1953, he began a destabilization campaign. The CIA went into Iran, began to pay opposing groups. Now, whenever you want to overthrow a government, the first group you reach out to is the military, right? So they reach out to the Iranian military. The other part, and this is what's going on too all over the place, which I always found interesting because even today we have this raddest, insane Islamophobia going on in the United States. These Muslims are bad and we got to get rid of them. And places like Texas and some of these crazies and going after al-Sayed and the people of Dearborn, right? So there's this rampant, virulent Islamophobia, right? The United States.
And it's not just Republicans either. It's like,
No, it's not.
Mike LaRosa, who used to work for the Bidens.
AIPAC and it's Chuck Schumer. None of these people said a goddamn word when Mamdani was essentially being threatened with his life by Randy Fine and others. And yet they come to the defense of Randy Fine and so on, right? No, it's not at all, right? But when the United States got involved to try to overthrow these governments, the first group they always went to was the military. Then it would be the clerics, the imams, because Islam often opposed these secular governments. And Mossadegh was a secular leader, absolutely, right? So the CIA went into Iran, made overtures to the military, to some of the clerics. They began to use psychological operations like they would in Guatemala and all over the place. They would put out announcements and have radio alerts and things like that, talking about what a threat Mossadegh was and how the communists were going to come in. We've talked about Indonesia before on this show, right? And it's kind of, it's an old playbook. In Cuba, they invoked the Catholic Church. They got the Catholic Church behind them. In these particular cases, you get the Muslim community behind you, or you try, right? In late August of 1953, August 19th, 1953, Mossadegh was overthrown. It was a bloodless coup. Mossadegh could have called out troops to suppress this coup attempt. It could have been bloody. There's a chance. I'm not an expert on Iranian history. I've read various accounts of it. By all accounts, there was a chance he could have maintained power. He could have held on. But he understood correctly, I believe, that would have just invited even more U.S. involvement in it and would have been even bloodier. It would have caused harm. He left office in a bloodless coup on August 19th. August 19th is the end of it. It's been going on for years, actually. Before that, the Shah of Iran, Shah Reza Pahlavi, the father of this clown running around L.A. now claiming that he's going to take over Iran, right?
Yeah.
And the son of the previous Shah of Iran, Reza Pahlavi, took over as the monarchy was restored. He took over as the Shah of Iran. And the United States then had this relationship with Iran. Iran was a repressive state. It had U.S. support. It had U.S. weapons, significant amounts of U.S. money. The U.S. helped train its security apparatus. The Shah repressed his own people and made the country very favorable for American economic interests. As the period went on, 1960s and 70s, Iran kind of became the counterpart to Israel, actually, as America's ally in the region. Between 1973 and 1978, I could go into way more detail, but we don't need to do that. But
we've done shows on this too.
Between 1973 and 78, Iran received $19 billion. And back then, a billion went further than it does now. We're talking about a six-fold difference, right? 6-1. So the United States gave Iran $19 billion in military aid just in the 70s alone. There's that famous ad where the Shah of Iran is doing an ad for nuclear power. So Iran still has massive oil royalties. However, the people of Iran are living in very poor conditions, right? Incredibly wealthy country, but that money is being obviously contained at the top, more, probably even more than we're seeing it here, like in the U.S. today. This has nothing to do with communism. It has nothing to do with human rights. This is about oil. It's about the control of resources, power. Its intervention is based on lies. It's based on misdirection. It's based on coercion and force. And what it did under the guise of ending communism and bringing democracy and human rights to the region actually guaranteed massive repression under the Shah until 1978. And then the Shah was replaced by a radical regime, which continued that repression as well. So when the U.S. says, oh, Iran has been attacking America for 47 years, I'm not really sure other than obviously the hostage situation, right? But Iran's never invaded the United States. Iran has never tried, despite what Trump says, Iran's never tried to assassinate him. Why would Iran want to assassinate Trump? Trump's the best thing that's ever happened to him. Iran was like a global pariah, which now has broad international support because of Trump. It's just amazing what the guy's done. It's unreal how you can make Iran popular.
There was a recent interview with a Revolutionary Guard general who said that very thing. He's like, why would we want to get rid of Trump? We have gained so much from Trump coming to power.
Yeah. And we're going to talk about this soon. Look what it's done to the United States, too. The United States has taken this massive drop. It doesn't even have enough weapons anymore. Anyway, but so that's the coup, which I used to, you know that, right? Everybody knows that now, right? I've taught for over 30 years, and I remember when I started talking about this, I would often say, if you were going to make a list of the most important events of the 20th century, right? What would you have on it? So you would have World War I, World War II, maybe you'd have the New Deal, the rise of Hitler, the emergence of the Soviet Union, whatever, right? It's like, you have to have the 1953 coup in Iran on it. That is one of the most important events. In retrospect, it keeps getting more important all the time because the Third World really learned what was going on at that point. Right. And like in Iraq, and actually throughout the entire region, nationalists and communists always said, we're not going to be Iran in 1953. So that was clearly a signal to the entire Third World what the U.S. would do. It was prevalent in Bandung. It was prevalent in Cuba. It was prevalent in Johannesburg, prevalent in Hanoi. Everyone knew what the U.S. had done in 1950. So it's, you really can't understate just how vital, how important this was. And that's what brings us to today. This isn't 47 years of Iran attacking the United States. It's actually
73 years.
Yeah, or 80 years. If you want to go to the end of World War II, it's 80 years of the United States. And even before that, the British in the United States, stealing Iran's oil, denying its own sovereignty, attacking its own people, and making the standard of living for every Iranian, not every Iranian, not those associated with the AIOC and others, but making the standard of living associated with Iranians much worse, much more dangerous. Iran is not in bad shape, as our good friend Iskander has said. Like, Iran has coffee shops, and they have cafes, and they have restaurants. And if you've ever seen photos, right, it's a thriving, Tehran's a thriving, it's a big country, right? Imagine without this, these decades of attack from the United States, Iran, and that's the thing that people don't, when they say, oh, socialist country, look at what shitholes are. It's like, they were never given a chance to develop. Like, right. You've been in Vietnam, I've been in Havana, right?
Yeah.
It's amazing what those countries have done, considering they were like vicious, and Cuba still is viciously attacked by the United States. Remarkable. You know,
when we talk about Cuba, we can talk about the proliferation of medical doctors and experts and people who work in the medical field in Cuba, despite all of that. Iran has one of the, Tehran University has one of the top engineering schools in the world, in the top three, I think, which the U.S. has recently bombed, by the way.
Yeah.
But it's a well-educated, you know, populace, right? It's not mired down in poverty, like Iskander and others should tell us all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. The American allies are the countries like that when the United States goes in, because it doesn't care about development. The thing is, real socialists, and some did have, not an idiot, some were very repressive, right? But they also did believe in development, in healthcare systems and in education systems and so on, right? And so that was happening. The United States put a stop to that under the Shah, right? And which we now see reemerging, right? And as you pointed out, and it's not a coincidence in Gaza, in Lebanon, in Iran, that some of the first targets include schools and hospitals and
universities,
infrastructure, universities, and so on, scholasticide, medicide, because those countries, it goes back to what JFK famously said, is the threat of a good example. That's why the fact that Cuba has survived for 66, 7, whatever years now is actually quite stunning. If people understood the depths of what the genocide did, I'm sorry, the blockade did, the Cubans have a sign right outside Jose Marti Airport, the greatest genocide in, what is it, Genocida Mas Grande, Bloqueo, right? And it's true. It's just amazing. They're driving 1947 Fords with Hyundai motors, and they make their own refrigerator units, and all with the most intense blockade ever. And so take it off there. But that's what the United States did to Iran as well. And for all these reasons, the hostage situation for sure, but there are a lot of cultural reasons. It's kind of Orientalism and Islamophobia. Americans always see the Iranians as these demonic people, right? It's actually like been around a lot longer than the United States. I hate doing civilizational or cultural arguments, but look at Persian culture, Persian civilization. It's been around. It's amazing. One of the more important civilizations in the development of human history, right? Far more than the United States, right? Although the U.S. did give the world adult diapers, which is really coming in handy now, right?
So, gold-plated toilets, right?
Gold-plated toilets and Trump bitcoins and all that. That's the last thing I'll say. And this is also, if you ever look beyond the reports when these negotiations that are taking place, America's negotiating team is Witkoff and Kushner, who are a son-in-law and a realty agent, right? Take a look at the
Golf buddy.
The Iranian negotiating team, they all have PhDs, they're nuclear scientists, they're experts in and enlightenment philosophy, they're engineers. It's a society far more than the United States, that values education, that values intelligence, that values expertise. And I'm not trying to put a veneer on it. There's repression in Iran. There's no doubt. Yeah, you'd be an idiot to deny that. We see it. But at the same time, the United States is kidnapping people in the streets and sending them off to detention. Who knows where? People are going into ICE detention centers and never heard from again.
8,000 in July was the number I saw. I think, as we kind of get up into more current events, there's a lot of dysfunction. There's a lot of disaster, which is really unfolding with the war. And one of the things that we wanted to talk about today as part of this is what's been in the news a lot, which is the USA Blinken. And so it is the longest naval deployment in history. It's been out since November, something like, what is it, like 9-10 months?
270 days, I think, going on around 270 days, something like that.
Right. And we're really starting to hear these reports about corrosion in the toilets, lack of food, rationing food, multiple suicide attempts. The families, it seems like the families have gotten organized behind the scenes and are very much speaking out. There was a parent who wrote, it's interesting how Stars and Stripes and whatever the Navy media outlet is actually still somewhat on it, being a little bit honest with what's going on, particularly since Hegseth is in charge of all this. But there was a parent who wrote a letter to Stars and Stripes who said, my son is currently on that ship. And listen to him say that he and his shipmates constantly think about jumping off the ship just for relief is so hard to listen to. Our loved ones are out there fighting with no understanding as to what they're defending. I think one of the things we're seeing, because our military is now being run, they fired lots of people who weren't loyal, or because they were black, or because they were women, or what have you. But we're really seeing this sort of erosion of the U.S. military. And it's really playing out with this war with Iran. Another big story that's really related to this is the depletion of missiles and, you know, Patriot missiles, which would shoot down incoming attacks. So it's actually a very concerning, particularly if you're one interested in national defense. I'm not necessarily arguing for national defense, but we're actually seeing a real sort of breakdown here. And it's also worth noting that they've actually been so incompetent in their strategies that the sort of big logistics center in Bahrain was actually one of the first things hit, which is actually partially why we're seeing all these supply issues on the Abe Lincoln, as well as other parts in the Middle East.
Yeah, the U.S. media has done, it's hard to say they're typical disasters, because I think it's maybe worse what we're seeing since February. Yeah, many American targets were hit all over the region, including headquarters, which significantly impacted the American military's ability there. The weapon shortages is really quite stunning, right? You've been dealing with budgets that up to this point have been close to $1 trillion. The new one is over that. And yet they're almost out of interceptors. They had to get interceptors from Ukraine to redirect them to the region. You have military people now publicly saying, what my favorite was, I forget what the general's name was. He basically said, we might not be able to protect Israel anymore. That was their concern, right? Yeah. The amount of money spent, the amount of weapons exhausted. And this kind of goes back to what we started with, right? It is this clear American unawareness or ignorance or just rejection of Iranian history. And we talked about that before. It's very clear, like early on in February, there were people, including Dan Kane, who was Trump's guy, who told him, look, this isn't going to be that easy. They're going to close the Strait of Hormuz and all this stuff. And Netanyahu and Trump said, oh, no, it'll be over before then, right? And so now we're seeing how this plays out. The morale of the sailors and soldiers was never good. We saw that with the USS Gerald Ford, plumbing, with the fire.
Sabotage of those things.
Sabotage. We've talked to Zach from About Face two or three
Zach
times.
Zach Henson, yeah.
One of the GI hotlines put out a statement, this is many months ago, saying that they were getting record numbers of calls. And the two things they kept hearing was, we don't want to fight. The two or three things, actually. We don't want to fight for Israel. We don't want to fight for Jeffrey Epstein. And even more than anything else is after the Manab school with the 168 little girls was blown up, but soldiers hadn't signed up for this, right? And remember, look at the way that Trump went after people like Mark Kelly and others for telling soldiers they didn't have to obey illegal orders. And what's really not surprising at all is Trump's callousness toward all this. Remember, this is the guy who said D-Day soldiers were suckers and losers. He cut VA, and he still gets support among the military, which is really quite remarkable. But in this recent period, he said, oh, the parents aren't complaining. They should be out longer. Just rejecting any idea of what they're putting them through, right? This is part of that whole machismo thing. It fits in perfectly what we talked about just a couple of weeks ago with Jasper Craven.
Jasper Craven, yeah.
Jasper Craven, right? This is this kind of macho Christian nationalist, insane, give them testosterone culture. And we're seeing how it's playing out. I study Vietnam and I actually began by studying soldiers, and I did study up in Vietnam. You had a massive rejection of the war from people in the army, from soldiers themselves, fraggings, dishonorable discharges, morale, racial incidents, just horrible. And the war itself was an utter disaster, which I think was in many ways the worst U.S. foreign policy debacle I'd seen in contemporary America. This has already surpassed it. I'm close.
Yep.
Because U.S. Vietnam, in a sense, was isolated in that region, right? And once Nixon came in and started making these overtures to China and the Soviet Union, any real possibility of some kind of regional attack on the United States was gone. Trump has pissed off everybody here. None of his allies trust him anymore because they've been targeted. You can't take America's word. Israel, I guess one of the good things is kind of Israel's isolated globally now more than it has been, right?
Yep.
But it is such a disaster, like an incalculable. And the impact, the other thing about Vietnam is Vietnam did impact the global economy, which hasn't really been studied that much, but it actually had a big impact. But this is cratering the global economy. I can't think of anything other than the two world wars as big, that has as big an impact, a negative impact on the global economy is what's going on. And we're not even 6 months. We're not even at 6 months yet. It was like the end of February. So we're not even at 6 months.
We're about five and a half months in, I think.
Yeah, it's costing over the official Pentagon costs are way low, right? Look at the cost of war project. It's costing over $1 billion a day, right? The United States continues to send aid to Israel, right?
Yeah.
It's running out of, and some of these weapons are going to take 3 to 5 years to replace. There's one country that's doing better now. One country has improved. That's China, the People's Republic of China, right? By doing nothing, by letting Trump destroy himself, which isn't hard to do, right? Globally.
The one thing I want to throw out there is that there's corruption and then there's incompetence going on here, right? And we've been hearing these stories about how Witkoff and Kushner were actually doing insider training on information they would get in the negotiations with the Iranians, which I want to just say is, at least publicly, we've never seen anything. It's unprecedented. And there's where the Trump media company is basically charging people in Wall Street $100,000 a month to be able to have early access to Trump's Truth Social posts so that they can do their own sort of inside. It's a version of insider training as far as I'm concerned. And so that corruption is astounding. We had a show with Protop Chatterjee back in July, which I actually feel like talked about that, the levels of corruption that we see with the Trump administration. But then the incompetence is, honestly, I think Trump continues to go back on the deals that they do make with Iran to the point where Iran's not going to make deals anymore, partially because he doesn't know what else to do. He tries to bully Europe. He tries to bully Japan. He tries to bully South Korea. His most recent thing is basically he's not going to help South Korea against the North Koreans anymore. And he's really good friends with Kim Jong-un. And so therefore, he's going to help him. By the way, do you know who North Korea supports publicly in the war? Iran, right?
He's also threatened to blow up Oman.
Oh, yeah.
He's the only country that's made some breakthrough in terms of diplomatic settlement.
He's bombed the shit out of him, actually, is what he said.
Iran will cease his civilization. About a month or so ago, I went on Dennis Bernstein's Flashpoints. And at the time, I wish I kept it. I had a list of Trump declaring ceasefires and then what the stock market did the next day. And I don't think it's an exaggeration to suggest that's maybe the whole purpose for the war at this point. It's just to build up his own stock market. The other thing you pointed out is bullying people. Another main reason this hasn't ended is because the Democratic Party won't go along with it. This is the one time the Democrats are willing to make a stand against ending the war in Iran because they're so goddamn pro-Israel. I want the war to end because people are getting killed. American soldiers are jumping off carriers and 168 schoolgirls in Manab were bombed. And you should want the war to end. And yet the Democratic Party, this is the one fucking time Chuck Schumer has his fucking nerve. He's got a little bit of testosterone and says, we're not going to help you. You're a sucker, taco, you're weak, blah, blah, blah. Let him end the fucking war. It's just, I can't understand. It's like these Trotskyists who are like all in on Ukraine and this and that. Dude, end the fucking wars. Just end them.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ. But it's, this is where we are. It's horrific. And it's inflation in the U.S. There's an agricultural crisis in the U.S. Fertilizer prices are triple what they had been. The price of gas, obviously, it's back up over $4. The other day, I saw it at $4.47 here in Ohio.
Price of food.
Price of food is crazy, especially meat, especially beef. Oil keeps zigzagging up and down. I think it was back at about 100 a few days ago. Who knows where it is today? There's just no, it's just so erratic. And it's Trump's main priority in any of this. He has no ideology. He has no program. He has no policy other than his own pocket, like his own assets. Right?
I would say his ego. I would say his ego, too.
He's
He spends a lot of time wanting to put his name on the Kennedy Center and the ballroom. The ballroom.
The ball. Yeah.
That ballroom seems to be the administration's number one priority besides.
One thing I will say about Donald Trump, he is the most fabulous U.S. president ever.
I was looking at some stuff in prep for this. Is they basically want to aesthetically improve the design of aircraft carriers to match what Trump thinks it should be. And they're spending billions on that, right?
No other president in history has ever given a shit about like the interior design. Was it going to have like gold lamé? And Trump is the Liberace president, you know?
Yeah.
It's like these guys tell, oh, we're tough and we're macho. Like they're worried about like sconces and gold inlay. And it's fake, ugly shit too. When I think it was you who said he's going to replace Anchors Away within the Navy by the village people.
Yeah, in the Navy, right?
It's so fucking surreal. Like, you could not invent it. You couldn't. Gorbachev couldn't. Hunter Thompson couldn't. Mark Twain. Nobody could invent this stuff.
It's pretty unbelievable. And then the last thing I want to talk about, which is what the way in which Trump talks about this stuff publicly, is that the press, well, I will say that for 10 right-wing media people or right-wing influencers they have in the press room, because they've actually done a lot of, you know, culling of the actual press out, is there'll be one press person who is from CNN, which I actually feel is pretty compromised in its own right, basically ask about the families who are concerned about the service members who are on the Lincoln. And he basically just says, no, they're not. He just denies it, right? A reporter says, has the deployment gone on too long? And he's like, no, not nearly enough. And one, he was never one who actually went into the military. I guess he was in a high school military academy, but it's not like he ever saw combat because of bone spurs or whatever. But I just want to flag the sort of trying to shape the narrative and lie and deny what people's concerns are is just, it's so upsetting to me. It's outrageous. It's fucking crazy.
And as in all cases, the media kind of gives it the stamp of legitimacy.
Yep.
He can say the craziest shit and they just report it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's indeed bleak. I don't know if there's anything more, because I know you wanted to do a little tribute to somebody who died this week.
Yeah. Yeah, so maybe we can move into that. So the other thing that we wanted to touch on today, we're going to talk about two people who have died this week. So the one I wanted to bring up was Ward Churchill. So Ward Churchill was an academic. He was an activist. He was an author. He was a political radical. Ward Churchill is known for his writings. He had two main themes in what he wrote about, which were very connected. He wrote about the U.S. government's systematic attack on political protest, political dissent. He's known for editing the COINTELPRO papers, which detailed how the FBI and other government agencies went after the Black Panthers, the American Indian Movement, the New Left. I would say that and the other book, which is, it seems like a sequel or another version of it called Agents of Repression, which is mostly focuses on the Panthers and American Indian Movement, was really influential on me when I was getting my radical political chops. And then the other thing that he wrote about a lot was the genocide by the U.S. government of Native Americans. And his probably most known book on that is A Little Matter of Genocide. Ward Churchill was a professor at the University of Colorado at Boulder. On September 12th, 2001, he wrote an essay where he talked about people in the World Trade Center being a bunch of little Eichmanns participating in this horrible system of capitalism, which has led to genocide and war and things like that. He was accused of plagiarism by the state of Colorado and by the Republican governor, Bill Owens, I believe, and eventually got fired. And he had tenure, right? Yeah, and he lost tenure and he got fired. There was later a review of all of his work where they actually found no evidence of any plagiarism. And so he actually sued and won. But Ward Churchill died last week. I believe it was 78. So I just want to do a little bit of it. And Ward Churchill spoke out to radical groups through his entire career, talked about these movements which resisted the government and on many levels. But he passed away last week. And so I just want to do a big rest in power to Ward Churchill.
Yeah, I've used his books in my radical history classes, especially A Little Matter of Genocide. Like, I'd heard about genocide before World War II, the Holocaust, and so forth. But that was actually the first time I saw a systematic analysis of what it meant legally. So much of what I knew initially came from that. He put out a collection of essays called Indians Are Us, which focused on kind of Indian representation in popular culture, sports team names, and so forth. COINTELPRO repression. So yeah, really a vital member of that left community. And when you mention Ward Churchill, especially the plagiarism case, because I was a professor already at the time, so that was something I followed very closely. And at the time, 2001 was a big deal, but it was still not really typical that you would go after a professor for something like that. It happened during the Vietnam era. I'm not naive, but it was a big deal when they went after Ward Churchill. And the way they did it, instead of just overtly saying it's for your political views, they contrived these plagiarism charges. I remember one of them was he repeated that white settlers would put out blankets that were infected with smallpox and other diseases for the Native Americans, right? I've read that a million times. And they basically, that was one of the things they used because they said he didn't source it. It's in every account I've ever read, right?
So D. Brown, who wrote 20 years before him.
Right. No, everybody did that, right? So it was really outrageous. That also triggered in me what's recently happened, like in the past, in the past week as well. There's a scholar in Britain named Jason Arday who died by suicide last week. And he had been in the news. I never heard of the guy until a few months ago. He'd been in the news. He was, I believe, was he the first Black to become a full professor at Cambridge University?
Yeah, I believe so, right?
And there were charges of plagiarism, allegations of plagiarism put up against him. Now, it's a somewhat complex case, so I don't want to go into the details of it. Some involved his professional work, but I think that was looked into. But the bigger issues came from what he wrote, which was more of a personal memoir. And he did make some fabulous claims in it. He said he was like nonverbal until he was 6 and functionally illiterate until he was 18. He claimed to have run 30 marathons in 35 days. So fabulous stuff, right? And so there were questions about this. And some of it probably was made up. And I take plagiarism pretty seriously as an academic, right? But set that aside here, right? The way to go after plagiarism, which I do take seriously, is, and you do that internally, right? You actually make a presentation to whoever the relevant body is. It could be his university, it could be someone in the field, whatever. And you go from there. In this particular case, there were some professors who did privately talk to his chair, or the provost or whoever. But the biggest part of this came from right-wing activists who went after him because he was the first Black full professor at Cambridge. They claim, look, it's just like in Britain, but it's just like it's the shit Charlie Kirk and Turning Point we're doing, right? Charlie Kirk died, like a lot of the horrific stuff he said came out, and it should have. What Turning Point did was exactly this. Turning Point went after, they tried to get professors fired. There were academics in the U.S. who did attempt suicide because of Charlie Kirk. So this is what they did. And this is where it's really problematic. You can't have outside political forces coming in who don't know shit about the scholarship, who don't know anything about research, who only are there because they have this right-wing agenda going after this guy simply because he's Black. And he's on the spectrum. He's different. Absolutely. Right. So they're going after somebody who they know is different to begin with, right? And they conduct this pretty vicious attack on him. He did lose his tenure and lose his job. And then he died by suicide, right? This is somebody who probably, I don't know his medical history, but you're going after somebody who you know already has some issues, right? But even that's not the big issue, because as a U.S. historian, I take plagiarism very seriously. In the past 20, 25 years, there have been a lot of cases of plagiarism in the United States, right? I just want to talk about four, right? Brian Vandermark was a professor at the Naval Academy, right? Found to have used somebody else's work. He was knocked down from, I think, associate to assistant professor. I don't know. It could be from full to associate, but I think it was associate. That was it. I don't know what, I never followed him after that to see. I would assume he worked his way back up, right? But that was it. Kept his job. He was demoted in rank, right? Stephen Ambrose. You ever hear of him? Stephen Ambrose. You can make a case he's the most famous military historian in U.S. history, right?
So, very popular historian. Pop history, yeah.
Friends with Steven Spielberg and Tom Hanks, right? Didn't he write the stuff that Band of Brothers was based on?
Yeah, he did. Okay, but he's also really known for a Lewis and Clark book that he wrote.
Oh, he's known for everything. Really popular history, establishment historian, kind of a rock star historian, right? Accused credibly, proven to be plagiarized. No impact on his career whatsoever. Right. My personal favorite, Doris Kearns Goodwin. Doris Kearns Goodwin was married to Richard Goodwin, who was an aide for JFK and LBJ. Doris Kearns Goodwin got access to collections at the JFK Library that no one else has ever seen, because she wrote very reliable histories that made the ruling class, the liberal ruling class, look good, especially the Kennedys, right? She saw Joe Kennedy's papers. No one else did, right? Accused and proven to have plagiarized. What was her punishment? She became Stephen Colbert's in-house intellectual. She was on stage giggling with Henry Kissinger and others on his final show. No impact, right? Nary Oxman. You know who Nary Oxman is? Nary Oxman is famous because to whom she's married. Bill Ackman. Bill Ackman is the guy who, more than anybody, is responsible for the attacks on student protesters at Columbia. He doxed them. He publicly promised to destroy their lives. His wife was found to have plagiarized work on her dissertation at MIT. Zero accountability. Right. So whether what Jason Arday did, these fabulous claims, and it's weird too, because it's based on really more of a memoir than academic work, which is just entirely different anyway. Who doesn't lie about your life? So at any rate, you don't believe that I was actually John Kerry's first pick for vice president, but had to turn it down?
Yeah. They were with John Edwards, who was.
He got it because I turned it down. Yeah. At any rate, it's quite, and again, we're being outraged over the hypocrisy at all, which obviously is a daily routine. But whatever you think of Jason Arday, whether he did commit, death is not an adequate penalty, is not the penalty for plagiarism, right?
Yeah.
We don't see that among these establishment scholars in the United States, right? There are clear implications about race, about one's proximity to power, and so on, right? If you are on the left, you have to be very careful. If you're Black, obviously, you have to be very careful. If you're writing about Black history or women's history or gay history or whatever, you have to be very careful. When I write an academic paper, my footnotes are so long and boring because I put every source that I could ever find in that to try to preempt anybody saying this garbage, right? And War Churchill had to endure it. War Churchill actually did win his court case, but it was a Pyrrhic victory. They gave him $1.
They awarded him $1.
Yeah. Jason Arday, rest in power. He obviously did not deserve this. And this is what happens when you let these right-wing ideologues get involved in the academy. This is the whole basis of what Trump is doing. And in fact, yesterday, it's fitting, a report came out that people in the Department of Justice were pissed off at Trump's attack on the universities. And when they investigated him, they found no information, no evidence of this rampant anti-Semitism on campus. And in fact, the opposite was the case, that the people targeted, more likely than not, tended to be Muslims and people on the left. And they expanded it from anti-Semitism to go after trans kids and Antifa and all this other stuff, right? That's the real repression. There is no equivalence. There is no two sides to it. Jason Arday dies by suicide. Stephen Ambrose gets an HBO show, and Doris Kearns Goodwin gets to dance on stage with the butcher of Indochina, right? That's where we are today. I'm glad I'm retired now, to be honest with you. I'd love being a professor. because the cowardice of the universities is unlike anything I've ever seen. Over a year ago, Ellen Schrecker told us she thought it was worse than McCarthyism. At the time, you may have been able to challenge that. Now you can't. This is the all of these liberal institutions have failed and caved, and they're so craven. And this is where we are. And this is a big reason why we're here. Trump is not some evil genius playing 4D chess. He has brute force at his disposal. But I think the most important factor in everything Trump has succeeded at is the fact that he has no opposition.
Yeah.
These liberal institutions haven't done anything. They're meek, they're craven, they're cowardly, they're complicit.
Yeah. We talked about Israel destroying schools and universities and the U.S. doing that in Iran and Scholasticide. This is just like a different version of Scholasticide. At least the Iranians and the Palestinians are fighting back. Yeah. The Iranians.
Yeah, it's a soft Scholasticide here.
Yeah.
You're not using bombs, you're using culture and politics and all this to do it. But anyway, Jason Arday, that's just a horrific, tragic story about he's, 37 years old. It's just, and a lot of people that, the scariest part when anything like this happens is the number of people who are like really happy about it. What's the equivalent of, he should have complied when a cop kills a guy, right? He shouldn't have done that. Or driving somebody to kill himself is a legitimate response to allegations that you made up lies about your own life.
Yeah.
Really quite remarkable. And this is where we are really in a very dysfunctional and sick place. I was just going to say it all started on this date in Tehran in 1953.
And I want to do just another shout out of rest in power to Ward Churchill and Jason Arday. Folks, we've been talking about Iran history and Iran current events, plus talking about Ward Churchill and Jason Arday. If you like what you're hearing, please check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. If you're watching this on YouTube, hit that subscribe button. If you're listening to us on an audio platform, give us a rate and a review. And then if you really like us, go to greenredpodcast.org and hit that support button or become a patron at patreon.com/greenredpodcast. Bob, I hope the shipping container, the catering container has another day. I don't think it's over. I don't think we're going to, that's the last we've heard of the catering vans.
The guy hid in his bunker, remember?
That's true.
Tough guy.
Tough guy. Everyone out there, make trouble and misbehave. And we'll talk to you again really soon.